yet another entity named for Christopher Columbus and his unapparent discovery of the New World. I was inquiring into the remains of the front quarter of a Colombian mammoth, found in a clay lair at the bottom of a pond near the ski town of Snowmass, Colorado. The mammoth's remains are 45,000 years old, its age determined by dating organic matter buried in the peaty mud around it, and 11 rocks were found intermingled with the bones. The rocks are puzzling because they are found nowhere else at this site except on top of the front quarter of the mammoth. It's hard not to wonder if they were intentionally placed there. The site was designated as paleontological only, not archaeological. Museum scientists instructed researchers to speak of it in these terms, saying there was no definite human component, no scrapers, spears, or napped stone. But the rocks are peculiar. Big enough to pick up and carry in human hands, they are each roughly the same weight and size, as if they were chosen. A similar phenomenon has been recorded at glacial pond sites in North America and Siberia, rocks used to hold proboscidean carcasses underwater, thereby both preserving the meat and protecting it from scavengers. In Wyoming's Agate Basin, a pile of articulated bison parts with other bison bones is believed to have been a frozen cache. Dr. Daniel Fisher, director of the Museum of Paleontology at University of Michigan, studied megafauna caching techniques in the Great Lakes region. He has tried it out himself on a deceased draft horse, which he butchered with stone tools and anchored under ice. He reported at a Society for American Archaeology meeting in Minneapolis in 2014, "As long as ice remained on the pond, the meat stayed essentially fresh. By June, the meat had developed a strong smell and sour taste, but still retained considerable nutritive value." In 2015, Fisher excavated a nearly complete mammoth in Michigan. Its skull, with two intact tusks curving elegantly away from the head, was hoisted out of the ground on straps from the bucket of a backhoe. Stone flakes and the arrangement of the bones suggest that humans were involved, butchering the animal in one place and separating the meat elsewhere, caching it in water, he thinks, for later use. Fisher was called in to excavate the Snowmass mammoth in case it turned out to be the same phenomenon. He came away thinking it was, but the evidence remains too thin to say for sure. Many of his colleagues are not convinced. 11 rocks are not enough to prove human activity so long ago. The Snowmass mammoth is known as the clay mammoth, after the lens of clay in which it was found. When the discovery of the animal and others just like it was first announced, I drove over with my family to see the mammoth and mastodon long bones, tusks, and teeth laid out on tables fresh from the museum's excavation. Children were allowed to touch some of the dark remains, bones saturated from resting in the muck beneath a mountain pond. It was a combination of time travel and ancestral faunal worship, lines of people from surrounding communities filing in to see the discoveries. More than 36,000 bones came out of the excavation in a feverish 69 days as museum excavators worked ahead of construction crews on the floor of a drained reservoir being deepened for water storage. In all, parts of 4 individual mammoths and 35 mastodons were excavated from this 15-acre mud pit. Each had died at a different time, some tens of thousands of years apart, making this not a kill site, but a death site. The result not of hunting but gradual mortality in a place where proboscideans spent a lot of time. A bison skull had been found in dark loam, along with at least 10 others of the same species. Ware showed the skull to me as we passed through an aisle, and it was as big as my chest, long horn cores protruding to either side. This was bison latifrons, known to have horns stretching more than 6 feet from tip to tip. "That's what we call a holy mother of God bison," Ware said. Latifrons grew so large, possibly the largest bovine the world has ever seen, partly because of the wealth of Ice Age forage. It was also a size that would have given pause to Panthera atrox, Smilodon, and direwolves. Modern bison are thought to be smaller as an evolutionary reaction to warmer climates and the need to run longer distances, possibly to escape human hunters. The Ice Age was a different era for megafauna. It was stand and fight, defend yourself and your turf, the bigger the better. Most archaeologists are now willing to concede, conservatively, that humans were south of the ice by 15,000 years ago. But a quartered 45,000-year-old mammoth stored in cold water by humans at Snowmass would throw those dates off the chart. The clay mammoth falls into the category of Richard Moreland's 40,000-year-old shattered mammoth bones, found in Old Crow Basin, Yukon Territory. Archaeologist Steve Holen, former curator of archaeology at the museum in Denver, now running the Center for American Paleolithic Research, has identified 10 incidences of possible human-shattered megafauna bones from the La Cena site in Nebraska and the Lovewell site in Kansas from around the last glacial maximum. What is now the semi-arid steppe of the dry, high plains was then sagebrush and grasslands mixed with the occasional spruce or pine. Holen's finds in this former prairie suggest earlier waves of people than most scientists will allow. In one case, he reported, impact points on mammoth and large ungulate limb bones show how the bones were broken from marrow extraction and the production of bone tools and choppers. People were not only gathering marrow, they were making tools out of bone and carrying them away, leaving no other sign of their passage. It was the march of the bone smashers from the north, assuming they were people who actually existed. In 2017, Holen and his colleagues analyzed bone smashing from 130,000-year-old mastodon remains found at the Cerruti mastodon site in San Diego. These came with abraded stone cobbles, and the bones are arranged in a somewhat orderly fashion. The site is hard to mistake for anything but human, though many scientists don't agree, finding it too old to fit current models. It may, however, fit a more realistic model, where humans and even early hominids arrived not in one single time period, but many. The river cobbles found at this mastodon site were not near any river that could have rounded them, nor were other cobbles found in the area. They are out of place, and their pitting and abrasion suggest that they were struck against something solid in a purposeful manner, with a certain amount of focus. A uranium-thorium dating technique put the mastodon bones at 130,000 years old, which, if it holds, would have humans here in the Upper Paleolithic. People, or early hominids, may have made an appearance in North America thousands of years, even 130,000 years, before foragers first carried stem points down the coast, or the makers of Yuktai weapons and microblades gathered across Beringia seeking a way through Alaskan ice. Whoever these early bone smashers might have been, they arrived and then vanished. It seems the harder and deeper science peers, the older the firsts become. We want to know where we all came from, what oldest flickering thing in human history we can reach back to and touch. By every thousand years, the record grows more frail. Bones are searched through, scanning electron microscopes used to study cut marks on mammoth remains. Holen's finds do not establish humans in North America at these far-end dates, but they are a knot on a string to follow into the dark. At Snowmass, the tooth of a camel and foot bone of a horse also turned up in the dig, along with parts of three different giant ground sloths. One bone appears to have been chewed on by a short-faced bear, possibly scavenged. Ware showed these to me, one at a time, the knuckles in a box, a piece of vertebra on a shelf, a wing of a shoulder bone that would have covered most of a dining room table. To say humans were at the Snowmass site 45,000 years ago requires considerably more evidence than 11 similarly sized rocks. Death rituals have been widely observed among elephants, which place dirt and branches carefully on their dead. Perhaps mammoths, being of greater heft, placed boulders on their deceased instead. The going theory, however, is that these rocks fell from a mountain, rafted across the pond on ice, and happened to melt out directly above a sunken front quarter of a mammoth, falling neatly into place, no human agency required. Ware gave me a look of incredulity. "Really," she said, "is it so difficult to imagine people were here?" The first people would have been walking into a brawl, whether they got here as far back as 130,000 years ago or just 15,000. Studies of damage to carnivore teeth and jaws from the La Brea tar pits near downtown Los Angeles have shown high-impact living among Pleistocene megafauna, the sabers of saber-toothed cats snapped in two, skulls of predators fractured and healed from blunt trauma. From the oily, sticky pits, UCLA paleontologists Blair Van Valkenburg and Fritz Hertel examined skeletal remains of direwolves, American lions, and saber-tooths, and concluded that these carnivores utilized carcasses more fully and likely competed more intensely for food than present-day large carnivores. Ware doesn't fully agree with this assessment, saying there is no way of knowing whether direwolves or other predators utilized carcasses more fully, or whether they competed more intensely for food than present-day carnivores. All we can say is they broke teeth, had injuries consistent with hunting megafauna, and died by entrapment, Ware said. Modern wolves that I have studied are competitive, aggressive, and have a definite carcass protocol that utilizes a carcass in an efficient manner. We just don't know about fossils. We can only talk about their bones. Pleistocene coyotes were maybe twice the weight of their modern relatives, their skulls larger, teeth more precisely designed for shearing flesh, molars showing wear that suggests extensive large bone eating. They had the same damage pattern and frequency as modern gray wolves, pointing to a larger target prey size than modern coyotes. Everything was kicked up a notch, similar patterns appearing in the fossil beds of San Josecito Cave in northern Mexico, just south of Texas, and the coal-black tar pits of Talara, Peru. Humans were walking into one of the biggest meat and bone shows on Earth. The last peak of the bone damage appears to have occurred around 15,000 years ago. Wolf species at the time had three times more mouth damage than animals just 3,000 years later, around 12,000 years ago, meaning competition might have been fiercer, predators in greater abundance, and more and larger carcasses were scavenged and eaten. Ware speculated that humans were most likely viewed as a food source by Pleistocene predators. Ware researches extinct direwolves, an American animal similar to the modern wolf, but larger in every way, notably in the skull. Although she is trained as a physical anthropologist, she is not an archaeologist. She prefers studying the relationships between humans and the animal kingdom. Her dissertation showed that direwolves once lived and likely hunted in packs, much like modern wolves. She determined this by studying broken and healed direwolf bones from the La Brea tar pits. Some with terrible injuries lived long enough for their bones to begin to heal or fuse back together. The animals did not ultimately die of their injuries, but rather of entrapment in the tar pits. Her conclusion was that they needed some help to survive their injuries, the support of a pack to nurse them back to health. Ware imagined sophisticated communication networks implemented as direwolves closed in on a mammoth, a horse, or a human. Her boxy canids would have brought down their prey by hamstringing them and ripping at their flanks. A saber-tooth attacks differently, slashing arteries and organs so that the animal will rapidly weaken and bleed out. The hamstringing technique would have been more carefully orchestrated with more animals involved, pack hunters. I'd gone into the pathology collection Ware used for her dissertation at the Page Museum in L.A. The direwolf bones she studied had soaked in tar so long that they had a blue-black sheen, as if made of coal. The pathology collection was a gallery of dark grotesqueries, burls and healed breaks, femurs and skulls that look like Swiss cheese or beehives. A disturbing thing to witness, it is a hall of pain on shelves that the public never sees. I looked at knots and breaks, showing where canids had almost met their end, but were kept alive by their packs. During her dissertation, Ware and I spoke frequently. She confided that she was spending a lot of time thinking about what happened here, how the wolves must have dominated the landscape, and how they died. Going through tortured bones, how could she not wonder what La Brea must have sounded like as the animals became trapped, or what the smell was like in the tar as corpses sank into the mire? At the time, Ware had just been diagnosed with a rare bone disease, a form of osteomyelitis that could cause damage uncannily similar to the kind that afflicted the direwolf bones she was studying. An infection can enter the bone through the bloodstream or migrate from nearby tissue. Her disease could not have been caused by the Ice Age bones she studied, simmering in oil and tar for tens of thousands of years. But it was the same kind of infected osteological wound, her bone appearing hazy on the X-ray, as if it were vanishing, too full of holes to bounce back a sharp image. Her foot was ultimately amputated before the disease spread, taking off most of her leg below the knee. Ware, who had hoped to include her foot after proper preparation in her osteology collection, asked if she could have it back to send off for processing, but it was not to be. The specimen had been incinerated. Now she walks with a prosthetic. On her replacement leg, she illustrated the face of a wolf. Walking slowly, still learning to balance herself, she paused in front of a long bone from the clay mammoth. Darkened by layers of peat and bog water, the bone was the color of whiskey and shoe polish. "Those scratch marks," she pointed out, "do they stand out to you?" I could see what she was talking about on the rim of the bone, a couple of strokes possibly from a stone tool, possibly not. Like most finds from the site, this one had been naturally roughed up, scratched, and gouged. Researchers examining these marks on a microscopic level have concluded that they weren't caused by people, but by grit shifting in the matrix, maybe trampling by other animals. But some of them catch your eye. I asked about one rib that had clearer markings. I'd seen pictures of it, scratches looking like deliberate, repetitive motions, as if a single blade had been pushed in the same direction 45,000 years ago in the Colorado Rockies. Though the microscope said it was nothing, my eye couldn't help seeing rapid sawing motions through muscle and fascia. She said the specimen was out for another study. Maybe it would come back with a different conclusion this time. First people were interesting, but they were not Ware's primary interest. She was more intoxicated by what those people may have encountered. She saw in this mammoth bone an alpine valley in the middle of nowhere, the continental interior of the New World. The Roaring Fork River through Aspen, Colorado came out of glacier-clad mountains. Up one of its tributary valleys was a pond, fringed with fir and spruce, hidden at the far end like a jewel. Sunlight landed in the back of this U-shaped valley, where mammoths, mastodons, and giant Latifrons bison gathered in marsh grass. For a moment, the giant cats would have backed away, unsure of these spear-bearers and their dogs. Mastodons would have lifted their heads, wondering at the commotion. Chapter 6. Emergence. 16,000 to 14,000 years ago. In the Oaken Hills of central Texas between Austin and Waco, a spring rises along a tangled fence line, watercress waving downstream. Water comes up clear and clean, like diamonds running between willows and meaty cottonwood roots. Even on dry years, Abbott Springs keeps a good flow, 2 to 3 liters per second from deep below the head of Buttermilk Creek. A short walk along the creek reveals dove-gray pieces of chert everywhere. You can't walk without stepping on them. The kind of rock is called Edwards Plateau chert, a local outcrop popular for toolstone since the late Pleistocene. I know a modern napper who comes here to collect rock to take home and fashion into stone projectiles. It's one of his favorite toolstones to work with. An archaeologist, the only one working the weekend shift at what is known as the Galt site along Buttermilk Creek, showed me where butchered parts of a mammoth had been excavated and filled back in. Nearby was the site of a horse, a Pleistocene bison. Some of North America's oldest, most well-stratified human dates come from this site, dates as far back as 15,500 years ago. This was one of the earliest documented gathering places on the continent, material generated by people coming back over and over. Buttermilk Creek is a hunting, butchering, and stone-gathering location, holding the remains of so many stone tools left across so many thousands of years that the ground seems to be as much tool flaking as actual dirt. Charcoal, bones, and napped rock from the 15,500-year-old horizon up to the historic Comanche people constitutes Earth. The Galt School for Archaeological Research out of Austin, Texas, has a central dig under a white tent that looks like a religious revival in a grassy field between oak bosks. 15,000 years ago, this land was 1,200 miles south of the ice cap. It was temperate, environmentally similar to what it is now. The spring would have flowed about the same, toolstone being struck, crystalline sounds ringing through oaks, the music of the first people. A camp near a spring at the head of a creek with good toolstone would have meant the scent of smoke drifting through woods, and you would have heard human voices, languages brought down from Siberia, or perhaps carried over from the Iberian Peninsula beyond the Atlantic, as some researchers believe. The oldest clear sign, so far, of architecture in North America was discovered just across the field from the tent. The floor plan indicates a rectangular layout, the distribution of artifacts made of stone and bone revealing an outline of walls, an entrance, a cooking and eating area. A floor plan, as defined by archaeologists, contains the shadow of living. If I'd ducked into this rectangular hut all those thousands of years ago, I'd most likely have been overwhelmed by the smell. To them, it would have been the scent of home, wood smoke, meat and skins, and family, a refuge from woodlands full of mammoths and saber-toothed cats. Home is a shape, a space, and for the people at the head of Buttermilk Creek, it had square walls. The structure was dug into the ground with a fire pit inside, its floor plan divided into tasks, an orderly arrangement. Similarly laid out Paleolithic footprints have been found in Europe, rectangles dug in with fire pits and artifacts in the same positions, entrances designed the same. This was pointed out to me by Michael Collier, one of the senior archaeologists at the Galt Center in Austin. Collier opened plan maps from these European sites, showing shapes and artifact distributions similar to what has been excavated at Buttermilk Creek. He said what puzzled him was that the Texas site he excavated is older than those in Europe. I asked, "You mean they could have been moving from here to there?" Collier leaned back from the maps and said, "You said it, I didn't." The question of where people went, when, and how could find answers in a pit like this. Tools tell origin stories. Bones of animals speak to meat and fire. Near the entrance of the tent at Buttermilk Creek is a signpost with three arrows pointing different directions. One is marked Iberian Peninsula, the other Siberia, and the third Monteverde in Chile and Patagonia. These are three key locations for the nascent Americas, the Iberian Peninsula being a reference to a possible arrival of people from Paleolithic Spain, Siberia pointing back to the land bridge, and Monteverde referencing an anomaly on Chile's southern coast. The signpost felt like a collective sigh from the archaeological community. We're not sure where everyone came from. Maybe everywhere. A Colombian mammoth would have been dappled in shadow, standing still, waiting out the afternoon head deep in the shade of the oaks. Its tusks would have been raised high off the ground. The slightly smaller mastodon has tusks that curve gently forward. The Colombian mammoth's tusks bow outward and then curve back in, almost touching, like a Valentine heart. The big white tent through draping plastic doors was cavernous. A lab and temporary artifact storage focused around an excavation pit almost 20 feet deep. Fans whirred and a generator ran outside, pumping water from the excavation so it wouldn't fill up like a swimming pool from ground flow. A wooden stairway had been built from fresh lumber, the wood unfinished, everything screwed together so that this place could eventually be taken apart again, the hole backfilled, grass grown back into a pasture where livestock would graze, knowing nothing. The uppermost excavated horizon was the size of a living room. Down through tiers, the pit became smaller, passing into older dates, arrowheads and small points belonging to post-Columbian Indians, Comanches. Below them were mound builders, woodland hunter-gatherers from 1,000 years ago, people who would not have known of Europe. Another few steps, and I was at eye level with layers of archaic big-game hunters from the cooler interior of the Holocene, 6,000 years ago. Down the wooden stairs, flakes and bits of charcoal stuck out of walls, the leavings of people returning over and over for the goodness of this spring and its Edwards Plateau chert. Below them were paleo-archaic hunter-gatherers, who also knew of this chert, learning of it from those before them, the Pleistocene people, the mammoth eaters. The stairs continued down, past nails tied with bright string marking study grids, damp dirt walls becoming soaked the lower I went. The water table came up around me, bones of horses and mammoths found in layers, part soil and part water. At 13,000 years ago, I was in the Clovis Age, the rise of the great mammoth hunters, long thought to be the first people in North America. Their unique stone tool technology swept the continent like wildfire. I descended deeper into human occupation, 14 and 15,000 years old, the pre-Clovis layers of Buttermilk Creek, which have produced 15,528 artifacts in the form of broken pieces of tools, rock flakes, projectiles, and worked bone, proof that Clovis was not first. At the bottom of the pit, a wood plank was up on blocks above standing water. The plank bowed under my weight, touching the oldest muddy human horizon, last of the worked stone, sterile soil below. The bottom date at Galt has reached 15,500 years old, a solid time frame for human arrival in this part of Texas. Clear plastic bags were in a bucket, each numbered, each holding a rock flake that had been found in this deepest horizon. I thumbed through to the bottommost artifact, a humble chert core knocked around its edges to get it down to a workable carrying piece. I opened the bag and slid the worked stone into my hand. It was a discard, something the toolmaker had thrown aside. Maybe the particular rock wasn't liked, had too much patina on one side, or was too thick in the middle. It could have been picked up and worked again, but it was forgotten. Almost as big as my palm, it was heavy, and sharp enough it could have cut flesh. My hand wrapped around its cool surface, slick and gritty. It felt amniotic, still wet from birth. I spoke with a Navajo woman, Nikki Cooley, who graduated from Northern Arizona University and works in the Grand Canyon as a river guide. When we talked about where each of us came from, she told me, "I firmly believe we did not migrate here. Maybe we crossed the Bering Strait when we were hunting. We probably went there and back, but I don't believe we came from there. We came from here, first man and first woman." Instead of the scientific story, Cooley believes that the people came from the ground, her people story. She told me, "My dad always says, people say I come from Page or I come from Flagstaff, when I don't come from any place but Earth. He picks up a piece of dirt or a rock and says, I come from here. I have friends who are scientists and they talk about it. I politely listen, but I disagree." Not everyone thinks this way. A young Navajo man I know out of Page, Arizona, doesn't care for fundamentalism. He tells me the Earth is round and his people originally came from Asia. Disparities in belief are common in any human society. The belief that the Navajo, a people who call themselves Diné, the people, and many other Native American groups arose through the ground, often chased by a world-ending flood, is ubiquitous. In Diné tradition, in northern Arizona and the Four Corners area, the people came up from the ground like corn. When they first reached this world, known as the Fourth World, they found it covered in water and occupied by monsters. They had to unleash heroes to kill the monsters. In my mind, this means Ice Age lakes and floods when the land was ruled by megafauna, and the heroes came with spears made of rock or bone. A Diné singer named Buck Navajo told me, like Cooley, that they did not come from Asia. We met in his northern Arizona hogan on a chilly November morning, last gold leaves dropping off his cottonwoods. The old man said that there was no land bridge in his people's history. His hogan was a domed mud hut with corbelled wood for a ceiling, similar in size and shape to the earliest known shelters in Siberia and Alaska. I asked when they arrived to take up sheep and corn and finally call themselves Diné. The singer didn't speak English, at least not to me or to the companions who'd come with me. We were wanting permission to trek around the base of nearby Navajo Mountain, so we brought the old man ground coffee, grapes, apples, and a couple 20-pound sacks of bluebird flour. This is how it's done. Come with groceries and be polite. He said to ask anything we wanted. I had one burning question. How did his people arrive in the Diné Ta? I wanted to understand the ancestry of this place. I thought there'd be an oral history of migration, a cultural memory of coming down from the Arctic long ago. The old man's grandson stood over a half-barrel wood stove and interpreted as I went on spilling out my data. A cave full of Athabascan sandals found on the Great Salt Lake Desert near the top of Utah. Signs of people coming from a colder climate into the desert. There were direct linguistic connections from the Arctic to Arizona, including a branch of Buck's own language still active in central Siberia, where it appears to have shown up later, an American-born language washed back. I was digging myself deeper into a hole, thinking like a colonist. If I was new to this place, wasn't somehow everybody? It was as if I had come here with special news for him, and all we had to do was break the language barrier and admit we were telling the same story, science and legend saying the same thing. The response was again, no, they had not migrated to get here. I must have been misunderstood, I thought. We were lost in translation. Na Diné is a famously complex language family. The Navajo tongue was used as a code in World War II to throw off Japanese military cryptographers. Vowel length changes the meaning of a word. If a vowel is expressed with a nasal tone, the word's meaning changes again. Even in English, the question, how did people come to be on the land, could come off as, how did they come to be a people? That's where I thought we were hung up. Buck nodded slightly and spoke to his grandson. Without a hint of rancor, as if the words were plain as day, the grandson told me, there was no migration. We didn't come from somewhere else. We came from here, from the ground. The old man gestured down with two fingers, which were aged and crooked from work. I looked at the ground, red dirt, Moenkopi hardpack. I finally understood him, at least as much as I could. The ground is where scientists go to find artifacts. Fire hearths, weapons, bones, and stone flakes come from deposits from so many millennia ago that these people must have emerged in a world of floods and monsters. There is no clear geographic order to how any people first appeared. They seem to have followed rivers, but the sequence is hobbled because so much archaeology is lost. To scientists, it looks as if the lights came on in a house at night around 15,000 years ago. Texas, Oregon, Florida. Closet, attic, basement. If the appearance of bone smashers 40,000 or so years ago was the fishing out of the keys from a pocket to open the front door, this was throwing down the newspaper and putting up their feet. Home. To find the likely front door, come down the northwest coast below the ice and follow the big rivers in. These rivers were highways, rich with salmon, leading into the land through mountains and valleys, opening into vast interior watersheds, first the Columbia River as you head south, and then the Klamath. The mouth of the Klamath flows into the Pacific in Northern California through the Cascade Range. Near its headwaters, above Klamath Falls, it becomes marshes and lakes. These continue up to two forks of tributaries, the Sprague and the Sycan, and finally the headwaters and a crest on the east side of the Cascade Mountains, looking over the edge into rolling country thousands of feet below, the start of the American interior. Summer Lake Basin lies below in south-central Oregon, the lake now shriveled, appearing otherworldly, and anoxic, with heavy mineral concentrations, not a place where people go fishing. The water body would have been significantly larger and ice-free on a spring day in the late Pleistocene, muskox grazing its edges, 500-pound Panthera atrox, the giant American panther, perched on rock outcrops overlooking the herds. Dark stumps and branchless pines from old wildfires stand at the crest now. A cool, damp wind whispered through the boughs of the ponderosas that haven't burned. Over the edge, several thousand feet down in the high desert, this vapid, kidney-shaped lake nests inside of a shadow of its former self. From the crest, I spotted a dark point of rock on the far side of the lake, far enough away that even through binoculars it still looked meager, like a charcoal smudge. It was once a peninsula, reaching into an ice age lake. Now it's a lonely point of dry land, holding a number of rough, shallow rock shelters, Paisley Caves. Dried human feces, dating to 14,300 years ago, have been found buried under layers of dust and debris in these caves. Along with human coprolites, archaeologists found long-tailed obsidian projectiles, similar to those used on the coast of Siberia and Japan, all the way down to Monteverde in Chile, signs of coastal people arriving and moving inland via big rivers spilling from Oregon, Washington, and California into the sea. I drove down from the crest and stopped at the town of Paisley, Oregon, population 240, where I asked directions. At the bespangled Pioneer Saloon, open in the middle of the day, the bartender looked out the window at my rental car. She told me weather was coming and that the roads would be slick as snot. On the wall across from the bar hung a picture of Dennis Jenkins from the University of Oregon, who headed up work on the nearby Paisley Caves. It was taken in the field, a sunny day before the same point of rock I saw from the crest. At the bottom of the photo was written, Dr. Poop. I asked the bartender if she knew him. His crew came in every summer, she said. He's our celebrity, the Indiana Jones of poop. I finished my beer and got moving. Under growing storm clouds, winter not fully rendered into spring, I drove through sage-covered hills over bumps and ruts, places I had no business taking my little two-door. I didn't take the roads the bartender recommended, wanting to get up high first, have a look at this territory. The roads wormed up over and around draws and flanks of buttes, where I winced at the percussion against the undercarriage. I parked on the treeless flanks of a little mountain range, populated with dried-up stock tanks. Sage waved through basins and scarps of earth, rising and falling in tidal, tectonic rhythm. Spruce groves and grassy parks had occupied this area in the Ice Age, aspen trees twisting out of cracks in the boulders, green buds softening for spring. It wasn't that much colder then, between 14,000 and 16,000 years ago, but it was wetter, lusher, patches of temperate steppe frequented by horses and muskox. By the time Paisley Caves were in use, the height of the last glacial maximum long gone, 6,000 years in the past, massive ice caps melted at a quickening pace, which meant fresh water everywhere, waterfalls, lakes, and rivers reaching their height, permafrost retreating from the ground, grasses proliferating. Megafauna had ample brows, meaning meat for predators. Clouds streamed off the Cascades. Dabs of sleet pegged the ground, hitting my shoulders, nicking my cheeks. For time travel, stormy weather is best. The dry west can be nothing but sunny, everything cut into slices of shadow and light. On a day like this, sunlight turns into color and shape as shadows richen. Ghosts stir from the ground, silver-tipped rain on sage. A piece of napped obsidian lay at my feet, exposed by weather. I rubbed pale soil from it, spitting on the rock, thumbing off the mud to clean it. It was a scraper, a small cutting tool with quick edgework. I held it up, and gray sky seeped through its glassy fringe. Smoke-heated volcanic rock, common around here, it had been worked into a handy portable tool. A flint napper I know said to me, "Obsidian is a whore." A learned nod to its easily sharpened edge that dulls quickly, in no way a long-term relationship. Flipping it over and back, I could see hammer blows, first with a harder rock to knock off most of the junk, then the butt of an antler for finer flakes to sharpen the edges. It wasn't a museum piece, and who knew what age, a generic tool. You could find 10 of these in a day out here. On intermountain shorelines from here to the terraces above the Great Salt Lake in Utah, you'll see lithic scatter that landed like rain, the ground winnowed down to human enterprise. Tool flakes, bits of broken projectiles, and abandoned cores of glassy rock. Stone Age artifacts are much easier to find in the sage desert than in a forested place like New England, where soil is scarcely visible beneath fallen branches and leaf litter. Many finds in the Northeast come from toppled trees with their root balls exposed, rooms of soil walloped up from the ground, bringing up with them spear points, scrapers, and tool stones. The West is different, drier, more exposed. It is what is known as a deflating landscape, where sediments tend to blow or wash away, giving a decent chance of seeing on the surface where a napper sat to clean stone thousands of years ago, body folded over a piece of chert or night-colored obsidian, apron of flakes strewn across the ground exactly where they fell. I reached down and planted the scraper back in the ground, one of countless stone artifacts out here. I forwent a stove or dinner in the wind. With hands in my coat pockets, on a near-freezing early May evening, I waited for night, for an excuse to get in my bag and sleep. Blustery night. No stars. The rainfly on the tent snapped and tugged. Sometime after midnight, the wind must have stopped, and I could hear howls in the distance. I thought they were the low, breathy moans of extinct direwolves, Canis diris. I must have fallen asleep thinking of them. Bigger in body than modern wolves, this Pleistocene species would have sung with deeper tones. More breath, more howl. I heard one, and then another, like ragged bassoons finding each other in the dark. This is what people would have listened to in the middle of the night, direwolves triangulating and coming closer. This is the map they would have made, changing by the moment. Were the wolves grouping up or just moving through? You could tell where they were, isolated individuals coming closer to one another, numbers growing. On some nights, you'd want a cave. You'd want something at your back. My eyes cracked open, and I listened into the dark outside my tent. The storm had stilled. Coyotes were yipping in the sage far away, howling and whimpering like puppies. Coprolites from Paisley Caves, there are many, are kept in tape-sealed containers in a lab on campus at the University of Oregon in Eugene. These Ice Age scats have produced human proteins, and so excavators wear hazmat suits to avoid contaminating the specimens. Plastic containers in which they are stored are clear, so the dusty clods inside can be seen, not much to look at, a bit of hair and digested plant, some darkness of meat. After a decade of work at the caves, Dr. Jenkins, a.k.a. Dr. Poop, a senior archaeologist at the University of Oregon and head of the Paisley Caves excavation, told me, "We've got horse hooves and sinew, camel bones with flesh still attached. You can feel the flesh. You feel the fat on the bones. You're sitting there looking at the bones saying, 'This could be an animal hit on the freeway.'" I visited Jenkins, a weathered, erudite field man with a gray, cropped mustache, at his lab in Eugene. He explained that he'd had a hard time gaining respect for his coprolites among colleagues. Many paleoscientists insist he's found nothing but canid scat, oversized coyote, or possibly direwolves that were taking shelter here. It's true that most of the feces found in these dry caves came from wolves, coyotes, bears, and big Pleistocene cats, but Jenkins stands behind his assertion that he has identified enough human proteins to represent the earliest identified human craps in America. The data are not blindingly clear. Though human proteins are present, they are liberally mixed with feces left by other animals and dusted with cave contaminants. I asked Jenkins how he knew these were human coprolites and not the deposits of predators that had eaten humans and shat them out in a rock shelter. Jenkins said, either way, it still means people were here. We got some American lion coprolites, which just stoked everyone, he said. They're in Pleistocene deposits, same age as humans. This was Panthera atrox, which I imagined strolling into one of these shelters, sniffing the ground as cats do, smelling something peculiar. A new animal? At Wilson Butte Cave, in nearby southern Idaho, excavations over a 30-year period led by Ruth Gruen, professor emerita of anthropology at the University of Alberta, came up with dates that back Jenkins's assertion. Gruen's digs produced a basalt knife, a blade, a utilized stone flake, and two cut and butcher-marked animal bones in a layer that bottomed out at a radiocarbon date of 14,500 years ago. She found projectile points made from obsidian, which can be dated through a hydration process, to between 14,600 and 13,657 years ago. These are identical to what Jenkins found at Paisley Caves, the oldest signs of what is known as the Western-stemmed tradition, which eventually spread from here throughout the Great Basin and all along the West Coast. The oldest known rock art in North America shows up within the same time bracket, about 170 miles south of Paisley Caves. Images are etched into a gallery of dolmen-sized boulders along an evaporated lake edge in northwest Nevada. Minerals in the etch marks radiocarbon dated to 14,800 years ago. The art is not like Chauvet in France. No delicate animals or handprints. The rock is porous and rough, the images entirely geometric, in patterns as complicated as stained glass. Hand-sized honeycombs, geometric crosshatches, plant-like upshoots, the oldest known rock art in the Americas. The problem with looking at the earliest evidence is that there is essentially no chance of these being the very first people. Doug Bamforth, a paleoarchaeologist from the University of Colorado, told me, "There's going to be a time before they become archaeologically visible, so the archaeology we see has to be of people who've been here a while. There was a long period when people were here that we probably have never seen. That means the folks that we do see must have known their way around." Dennis Jenkins shares this sentiment. He emailed me, "What we have at Paisley Caves is not evidence of the first people walking over the horizon in Summer Lake Basin. One human coprolite has 9,000 Apiacea pollen per cc. Apiacea is a family of plants that generally have edible roots and tubers. The entire plant is edible, but the root is particularly valuable. To exploit such plants, you have to know the root is there and have the technology to get it out efficiently, digging stick and methods. In other words, its exploitation requires sophisticated knowledge about techniques, soils, and plants that had to be acquired through trial and error. This suggests to me that people were already in the region before circa 14,000 to 14,525 years ago. Jenkins' belief is backed up by an artifact recently found in a rock shelter near Riley, Oregon, about 70 miles northeast of Paisley Caves. Below a layer of stemmed obsidian points, similar in style and age as Paisley's, is a layer of ash from a Mount St. Helens eruption, firmly dated at 15,800 years old. At the bottom of this dig, 12 feet below the surface, and beneath this layer of ash, archaeologists found a single artifact, a small piece of orange agate worked by human hand into a scraper. Its position shows that the scraper has to be even older than the volcano eruption, a pin in the map around 16,000 years ago. I found the road to the caves through a few barbed wire gates. Not enough rain had fallen in the night to slicken the route, well worn by Dennis Jenkins and his University of Oregon crews, who'd pulled out of here 9 months earlier. The road led to a promontory of black rock, where lava flows had piled onto each other just after the age of the dinosaurs. They formed a ragged rock face a couple hundred yards across that once opened on a lake of glacial melt and rainwater, one of many lakes inhabiting the western third of the continent in the late Pleistocene, around 15,000 years ago. Hard to call them caves, they look more like the twisted mouths of ogres. They are seated in the rock, a balcony view, their shelters rough and just deep enough to get back out of the weather. I parked, put some gear on my back, and headed around the promontory's gentle, boulder-strewn flank. Sunlight shafted between clouds, damp sage making the desert look like water. The wind coming off the dried-up lake tasted like metal. Zinc-colored dust storms were kicking up several miles out, where the lake edge has evaporated so many times in the last several thousand years it has been reduced to its elemental components, potassium, silica, sodium, sulfate. Breathing it was like licking a gun barrel. With the glowing yellow sail of my tent up, I sat on a black, lichen-decorated rock, scanning the expanse, wishing these pegs of half-sleet would stop hitting me in the face. I had planned on staying down here for a day, getting a good eye for the topography before looking at the caves. I'd let the landscape seep into me, understanding where I am, where the people long before me must have been. The storm changed my mind, though. Why would I be sitting in the weather like a fool when a perfectly good rock shelter was nearby? I grabbed a water bottle and a journal and headed for the caves. The nearest and smallest shelter was a little more than a shallow vestibule, a narrow head-high space ending a few feet inside. A big bubble in ancient lava, it was just deep enough to get out of the wind. This cave had been scoured for so long it felt hollowed out like a rind. I wondered about ghosts, if such things exist, and if the wind eventually winnows them away. I poked my head in. Hello? No one answered. No one ever does. These caves have preserved some of the finest details, such as a piece of braided cordage, or the remains of a spur-throated grasshopper, hairs and tiny barbs on its exoskeleton still intact after more than 10,000 years. Tiny golden mandibles of Jerusalem crickets found in these caves have led archaeologists to believe people may have been eating these protein-rich insects, an easier mainstay than mammoths. From their feces, it also appears that the people relied on the root of the celery-like umbrella-flowered Apiacea plant. I entered and crouched in the back, facing out of the open mouth. Sleet spattered the toes of my boots. This, I thought, was much more like the places Buck Navajo described when he pointed at the ground and told me it was where his people came from. Firelight had flickered in this cave. Mesoamericans, living in the high valleys and jungles between here and South America, refer to Chicomostoc, the site of the seven caves from which the first people emerged, each cave issuing a different kind of people to populate the land. For the Chippewa, before anything else, a lone woman lived in a cave. For the Choctaw, people emerged from a mound where they crawled through a long, lightless cave out to the sunshine of the world. The Hopi, depending on the clan, came into this world through a hole in the earth, driven upward when the last world flooded. Paisley Caves is another legendary site, this being a legend of science. There are several separate chambers, and not all have produced human feces. The shallow one I'd chosen first was an outlier, like so many others in the upper Great Basin, turning up charcoal and Pleistocene horse hooves, layers of camel remains mixed with muskox, wolves, and coyotes. People had been found a few doors over, where dust in the rocks hold molecules of what I imagined to be an Ice Age man skinning out a badger, a woman cinching plant fibers between her teeth in the sun at the mouth of a cave. I explored one shelter after the next, and two pigeons flapped out of the largest, where human artifacts and coprolites had been found. As the pigeons left this protection for the open sky, I ducked farther in, moving past sandbags and backfill left by Jenkins and his crew. In the back of the cave, three perfectly proportioned eggs lay in a crib of twigs. The palm-sized nest looked like a quick attempt, no more than half an hour of pigeons scavenging pack rat middens for sticks. Columba livia is a rapid colonizer, Not originally native, it spread to nearly all of North, Central, and South America within a couple centuries of coming over on European vessels in the 1600s. The name of the pigeon's genus, Columba, comes from its ability to navigate, yet another moniker derived from Christopher Columbus. The name ends up on a lot of American species, including those who didn't start here. The original Latin name in the Old World was Columba Noachi, Noah's dove, the one sent out from the Ark in the Bible to find the first appearance of land after an Old Testament flood. The bird has found an island for itself at Paisley Caves, a small anchor in the American interior. Native songbirds weave baskets into the grass and sage. Their speckled eggs are hidden near the ground. These birds have been here since the Ice Age. Pigeons lay eggs the color of pearl. They are softer than prairie eggs, requiring less investment in their production. This allows for more rapid spread, exploiting niches at the edge of livability. 8 to 12 days after mating, a female Columba lays eggs, which hatch after 18 days. Nesting areas that prove beneficial are kept for life. Mated pairs often monogamous in order to hold the same location. If a nest is successful, it builds up. Feces and detritus pile up over time, and it eventually forms into a sort of mud pot, incorporating unhatched eggs and the mummies of dead nestlings. I like to think of my own history as less vulgar, but it is still a history of colonization, a tale of land grabs and uprooted histories, a quickly moving people with eyes on the horizon. It might be a trait of any organism engaged in dispersal and colonization. Here they ate roots and lived in the company of horses and giant curved-toothed panthers, stepping out of the same cave to see the same snow-topped mountains. Based on the evidence, they didn't put up their feet here for long. These caves were rarely occupied, with centuries or thousands of years between visits. By 12,000 years ago, stays in the shelter were more frequent, while in the beginning, people were few. The trickle would become a flood. The emergence would turn into an eruption. Chapter 7. A Dangerous Eden, 14,500 years ago. How they got to Florida, no one knows. It is unclear whether the first people in the southeast came from the Pacific coast or somehow across the Atlantic. They might have jumped to the Gulf of Mexico via Central America and traveled clockwise to the subtropical savanna of a Florida much larger than the one here today. Taking a different route, they could have crossed the Rockies from left to right, over the continental interior, where they would have entered the courses of the Mississippi, which carried them through more than 1 million square miles of drainages, all leading to the Gulf. It would have been an easy net to be caught in. Or perhaps they rose from one of the innumerable sinkholes and freshwater springs scattered across most of the state, coming up from the last world into this one. The breadcrumbs people left on that journey are too faint to call a route, but it is clear that they arrived in the southeast by at least 14,500 years ago. Finds from the pits of the Ascilla River, south of Tallahassee, indicate an early widespread appearance as far away from the land bridge as people could go in North America without falling into the sea. This put them in what is now the armpit of Florida, between Georgia and the Gulf, where rivers flow through birdsong, islands, and sinkholes. Some of the names are still on the maps in this part of the Florida panhandle. Tate's Hell State Forest. Local legend has it that in 1875, C.B. Tate goes into the swamps after a panther with a shotgun and hunting dogs, and crawls out 7 days later in a town 25 miles away. He is ravaged by insects, bitten by a snake, no longer has a shotgun or dogs. He tells the first person he finds, "My name is C.B. Tate and I've been through hell," and then he promptly dies. This is not forgiving country, never has been. Florida has one of the largest concentrations of direwolf and saber-toothed cat remains in the Americas. A southern species of short-faced bear, Arctotis pristinus, is well represented in the state's fossil record. Herbivores tend to be either armored in hard, hairy keratin or armed with tusks, claws, or horns. They were in a place where one was apt to be eaten. Near the Ikenfena River, about 30 miles across Apalachee Bay from Tate's Hell, two friends and I were hiking through the woods when we found a trap smeared with blood, urine, and short, coarse hairs. At first we didn't know what it was. We had to walk circles around it. Metal fence posts had been used as a frame, tied to wire fencing and greasy, battered plywood with orange baling twine, entry spring loaded. "It's a hog trap," said one. The other got down on his knee and looked underneath. The trap had an axle where wheels could be mounted if a captured hog needed to be transported. Two old bullet holes and the slick stains of blood on the wood made me think kills had happened in the box, a kicking, squalling blood spatter. We'd tied a canoe and a kayak off along the nearby Ikenfina and were venturing by foot, wading through knee-deep water among knobs of cypress trees and bearded tree limbs in search of beer. A quest before sundown as we headed for a road to find a bait and tackle shop. The Ikenfina is a minor but navigable river flowing out of an upper Taylor County swamp and into the Gulf of Mexico, and we were paddling up its current for a couple days, farther inland, exploring the country. Spring rains elevated the water table, river coming out of its banks and filling the surrounding land. An armadillo galloped away along a spit of knobby cypress knees, like a golden ball disappearing into the woods. The hog trap was on dry land, driven down a two-track and dropped here. "How big a pig, you think?" I asked. 200 pounds? Asked Pete as he tugged at the fence post frame, testing its strength. "Hogzilla," said Alex, a tall man with a runner's body, bald upstanding head like the top of a bowling pin, bright cheeks, and a full ruddy beard. The two were married, both in their early 30s, and they'd taken the last name of Carr from Alex's mother. Fresh from a boot-stomping wedding at a hot spring outside of Prey, Montana, they were on their honeymoon, and we converged for several days, our travels coinciding in these swamps and karst rivers. Their honeymoon was a month in the Florida backcountry, navigating waterways as they crossed parts of the state in a red, tiger-striped canoe. Pete and Alex weren't living much of anywhere you could pin down on paper. Pete, a small, energetic man of Germanic heritage with a crop of fierce black hair, had worked the previous season as a backcountry ranger in Yosemite National Park, where he'd taken 2-week solos through the granite batholiths of the Sierra, checking permits, making sure no one was being eaten by bears. Alex, meanwhile, worked on a wilderness restoration crew in the same park, removing trails, and before that he built trails for parks across the West and Alaska. At the time, it was illegal for a same-sex couple to marry in Montana, where they held the wedding, so they did the paperwork in California after waiting for an overturning of the state's proposition banning gay marriage. It was also illegal for them to marry in Florida, but neither Alex nor Pete were much into the politics of the institution. Their marriage was not an act of resistance. They portaged by Subaru wagon, loading a canoe onto the roof of their beater car, rainbow flag sticker in the window, eat organic bumper sticker, Colorado plates, which they used to jump between rivers, estuaries, swamps, and bayous. Alex, the tall one, had been kidding about Hogzilla. He had a perpetual smile in his eyes, as if he were holding back a joke. Hogzilla is the name given to the over 1,000-pound feral boars said to inhabit the South, according to likely apocryphal reports. Hunters reportedly killed them in the deepest woods, but official weights have never been taken and photographs could have been doctored. Fish and wildlife people say they are probably seeing 800-pound boars, the result of inbreeding and isolation of an invasive species brought by the Spaniards and mixed with every other invasive pig that came after it. That's big enough. Hogzilla, even by official definition, wouldn't fit in this particular trap anyway. He'd kick it to splinters and trot away, wearing a skirt of wire fence. Hogs were our modern-day version of mastodons, the most common large, bristling beasts of Ice Age Florida. Only one larger animal had been here, the Colombian mammoth, Mammuthus columbi. But Florida had many more mastodons, Mammut americanum. The East, especially the Southeast, was mastodon country, the animal closer in size and shape to the Asian elephant, while the Colombian mammoth was more like the African variety. Full-grown adult mastodons would have weighed 6 to 8 tons, tusks up to 7 feet long, pikes compared to the recurve of mammoth tusks, which were twice as long. The two have notably different teeth, mastodon molars being spiked, almost mountainous, masto, referring to breast, odon, to tooth, while mammoth molars are nearly as flat as bricks, with a reticulated grinding surface. Skeletons and skulls show damage from mastodon-on-mastodon violence, most likely males in rut. Tusks are splintered and bones are broken in places indicative of conflicts that could have been fights to the death, bodies crashing